This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The Valor Games returned to North Carolina this week for their sixth consecutive year. The event was created by the Veterans Administration to give vets and members of the armed services with disabilities an opportunity to compete in sports. Ashley Thomas is the woman behind the Valor Games Southeast. She brought wheelchair basketball to Cameron Indoor Stadium. She arranged for the air rifle competition at the Dean Smith Center. And she does all of that from her own wheelchair. Ashley Thomas was born with spina bifida, which gives her a personal investment in making sure that people with disabilities stay active. And she joins us now. Ashley Thomas, welcome to the State of Things.
Hey, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you so much, Frank.
It's good to have you. Tell us about the Valor Games. What are they?
So the Valor Games is a three-day competition for newly injured veterans or those who've been living with disability and finally are thinking, let me try to be active again, to try their hand at adapted sports. So over the 3 days, we do 11 adapted sports. And the conception behind it was really to get people active again after the recent war. And the journey with disability, the psychological impact, families trying to figure out what the heck we're doing. Sometimes it takes 2 to 3 years, maybe even 5 years to finally go, okay, this is where my outcome is. Now what do I do? So the games were really to be entry level and begin getting people engaged in thinking there is life after disability and there is sport after disability and just a way to mentally and emotionally and physically stay healthy with disability.
And they were developed by the VA, right?
They actually were the idea behind it. There are three others in the nation, and mm-hmm. we all were told, work with your resources, you build your model. So they're all a little different, and I am so grateful for being here in the Triangle because we have corporate sponsors, UNC, Duke, NC State. We were just very fortunate, and we had built strong relationships with a lot of the folks. So when we had the opportunity, I got a call from a very commanding man who said, we are thinking about rolling this out. You have 30 days to research and come up with a plan. I will call you on this date. Are you in? And I said, sure.
Who are you?
I will. Yes. Yeah, really. He was commanding. That's what he was. No. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Whatever you say, sir.
Why you? Why did they reach out to you?
Well, we were a Paralympic sport club. So that was a movement that started in the 2004-05. And at that point, Deloitte had done quite a bit of research. What Paralympics were nationally known was like a 6% what is Paralympics. So there began a movement of little groups like us who said, we're going to do these adaptive sports. And we became Paralympic sport clubs. And so we had an annual conference. We learned best practices. So by 2012, we were actually awarded the Paralympic Sport Club of the Year for the nation.
And we is at that
Bridge Two Sports.
Okay.
And Bridge Two Sports, were naturally growing veterans. I like to tease people and say, I don't discriminate. We don't mind what your disability is, and we don't care what color your skin is. If you are living with disability, we're going to find a way to keep you active. So our programs were cross disability, and we were organically bringing in veterans, not because we were trying to say, look how great we are, but the reality is in that journey, sometimes you need guidance and help on how to stay active and healthy. So we all reported numbers. We had significant numbers. I think that's part of the reason we were selected. And then, of course, with North Carolina having 9 bases and a very large population of veterans and active duty members nationally, it made good sense. So they were already selecting the state, and we were fortunate enough to be in a position to say we'll take it on. So,
what are some of the most popular events?
So I think at UNC, one of the biggest coups, and we kudos to John Book, we did get air rifle on the floor of the Dean Smith Center, which that was an amazing feat.
Tell me about air rifle. What is that?
So air rifle is, you have to do it indoors because you can't have wind. They're tiny little pellets, and you're basically shooting, at a target. There's mm-hmm. 9, and so you get a practice, and then you're shooting, and you score that based on all the different shots within a 8x11 piece of paper. For people who may not be able to use your hands, quads, that's quadriplegia, usually hands and legs are affected. through the North Carolina Wildlife Resource Commission. We have a tripod and a sip and release straw that you just have to suck and it will release a trigger.
Wow.
So for a lot of our military folks, you know, that is part of what their training is. So to be able to go back and do it, it's great. The other event you'll see at UNC is sitting volleyball, which really, if you're missing legs, you have the advantage. Missing legs and arms, you've got the advantage in sitting volleyball. And then the last one is bocce, which, again, is for more muscularly affected. So traumatic brain injury sometimes can affect someone to not have use of hands or muscular issues. So we do that. And then last year in bocce, we had our first blind group going through. So that was a new challenge for us, is to now bring a blind group of people into the event. Then we move over to Duke on day two, and we're in Cameron Indoor Stadium. We start out with indoor rowing because they had an awesome women's rowing team, so they had resource there. Powerlifting we do within one of the gyms, and then Kayville becomes our archery. So we do archery out there in Kayville, and then we do wheelchair basketball. And 2 years ago, that became an event. We were really honored that we could do wheelchair basketball in Cameron. We were the first wheelchair basketball there, so that was very exciting for us.
A couple of interesting stories about this. When you talk about adaptive in the first place, that means that somebody has to have figured out ways in which you can play this game.
Yes.
And what adaptations. Wheelchair basketball, there's a story around that because you have to have the right chairs to play.
Absolutely.
Right? And gathering those chairs became quite a journey. For
Yes, it was. Yes, the first year we demoed it. A sports chair costs about $2,500, and the wheels camber outward. So if you think of a mountain and it has a slope on either side, a sports chair, the wheels slope that way, and it creates balance. So when you're moving quickly, there's a stability at the bottom. But because it narrows up at the top, you're strapped in, and your upper body will make that chair move without using your hands. So it's designed to be very efficient. And when we did it, one of my board members, he was going all over the state collecting chairs here, there, and yonder. We pulled in some from Fort Bragg, had some. So it was an awesome, to me, our state is such a wonderful state because there is compassion here, and people will bring what they have to share. And so, yes, we were able to make that event happen. By gosh and by golly, and all over the state, people bring in chairs. So we did make that happen.
The rowing team as well. You talked about Duke, their participation there. And when you went to them, they were all in, I guess.
Yes. Robin was the head coach at that time. And when I told her what we were doing, she said, absolutely, we've got the ergs. So we have 20 of them. They're at your disposal. And so they brought him down on the floor, and then Mark McAndrew with Concept 2, you know, came in and helped run that event and create everything. So it is an area, adaptive sports cannot be done. We could not do it alone, and it's taken a whole community of people, some experts throughout the nation. USA Powerlifting runs the powerlifting event. So it is what I say, it's bringing our best to give back to those who served us first. And
well, let's take a look at how you got interested in all of this to begin with. You were diagnosed at a very early age with spina bifida.
Yes.
Well, tell us what that is.
So it is, actually I was born at birth. We knew something was wrong with my spine. It had not closed appropriately. And so it was called lipomeningocele at that time. Mm. Who can say those words? At that time, in 1962, when someone was born with spina bifida, the odds of them not living were significant. We hadn't had technology that could enable as we can do today. So at 4 months, I had my first surgery, and it took 4 months because they didn't think I was going to live, but I was still living. And so they went ahead and said, okay, let's see what we can do. And this was at Bowman Gray in Wake Forest. And my parents were told to have low expectation that I would never walk and I would be most likely, the term then was retarded, and that I would basically be a vegetable, I wouldn't speak. And obviously that is not the case, but...
Can you tell us more about the nature of what's happening? Your spine hasn't closed, right?
So mine had a membrane over it, but basically with spina bifida, it's a congenital birth defect at the base of the spine. Sometimes spines don't close. There's an environmental component. They've also linked it to a lack of folic acid. So we've learned some things, so we've prevented it. Nationally, it's gone down.
That obviously the connection with the spine is why there can be so many and varied complications.
Right? Yes, it can affect feet. Mine actually affected my lower leg. Club feet, which is basically a very thick, if the foot doesn't develop completely. So shoes was one of the biggest challenges growing up for me, was trying to find shoes. Weakness in the legs, lack of sensation. The other things that can be affected is your bowel and bladder. So those nerves are also kind of down at that range of the spine. And, you know, we talk about autism and the spectrum, but I think every disability has a spectrum. And certainly with spina bifida, you can see those who can walk with spina bifida, others who have very small legs, no waist. I mean, it's again, that there's a spectrum. So it can affect all sorts of different parts.
Well, we'll talk more about your journey and how it came to how you came to North Carolina. You did surgery here, but were raised in Illinois.
Yes.
So we'll talk more about that with Ashley Thomas, the founder of the nonprofit Bridge to Sports, host of this week's Valor Games happening throughout the Triangle. 3-day event gives veterans and members of the armed forces with disabilities and a chance to compete in adaptive sports. Just ahead, we'll talk about Normal, Illinois, growing up there, and how her journey along the way. A conversation with Ashley Thomas on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Ashley Thomas today, hosting the Valor Games Southeast sports competition for veterans and military members with disabilities. As a kid, she was diagnosed with spina bifida and spent a great deal of her life on the sidelines because of physical challenges. She now races in marathons, has her own kayak, and is committed to helping others push past their perceived limitations. So you talked about the fact that you had the surgery very early, 4 months. You were in Normal, Illinois. What are your first memories growing up in Illinois?
So for me, early on, I would say about three. Probably the biggest challenge was being able to find shoes. And, of course, in Illinois, you had snow. So winters, you know, you need to have shoes. So I think from my early childhood, that was one of my biggest pieces I remember. And then as I went to kindergarten, the other thing that started happening is if I laughed, I would wet my pants, which is a little embarrassing to say. But children are very resilient, and I learned very quickly how to smile but never to laugh, which in some ways is a little bit of an odd story, but I was very aware of what was going on around me. And so I think the two biggest things is not finding shoes, and then I just wasn't able to really laugh like others because that would create, you know, another outcome I didn't want. So
we talk about not finding shoes. You remember it. But is there a sense of your sort of how did you know that? I mean, it sounds like an odd question to ask, but if it's what you do, you don't necessarily notice.
Right. With my foot, it developed. I have a very wide foot. So today I'm a 6 length and I'm a 5. Or 6 double wide, so very, very wide foot, and a thick instep. So when I was a child, my feet had not gone through a lot of surgeries at that point. So I walked on the sides of my feet. My heel cords were short, so that made you walk up on your toes. I had hammer toes, and that means my little toe kind of poked up, and I would get, infections there because it would rub shoes. Boy shoes were a little bit wider at the time. We didn't have the same selection of shoes as we have today. So I'll take credit for getting diversity in wide shoes for women.
We having to find, but you had shoes. And in other words, did you go to school without them? And
no, but we had to go to Chicago and St. Louis. Yeah. I mean, the thing is we had to travel to the bigger cities to find a pair of shoes to go on these feet. And the orthopedic options weren't there at the time. It was a different time. So a lot of what we have today just weren't available.
And what were your parents telling you about how you should be through
all
of this?
So my mom was pretty straightforward. There's not a lot of nonsense sometimes with disability. And I have to say, as a person, being straightforward with children is probably your best answer. But one of the things she would say very early on is that, you know, the little girl that was in the room you were born with, she died, and you have an opportunity. So shoes are not all that life is. So helping me keep grounded in, you're right, I got an opportunity. Somebody else didn't. And I think, you know, with all things in life, but certainly with disability, finding, like today, even if the journey's difficult, you have an opportunity to do something. So what are you going to do with it? And I think that was really her perspective. Instead of going into, poor me, I don't have these things, it's being thankful. And I was smart. So the opportunity for me was, here, you're good with your schooling, go this direction. The other thing that she was really good at, we were part of a very eclectic community. We were part of Farmland USA. Everyone, you know, had gardens, and we all had to help. And canning and freezing, everybody had to be a part of that. And I remember I was between first grade and second grade as the first surgery I can remember. And I had surgery, and I remember thinking, oh, good, I don't have to dry dishes. And no. Here, you're going to sit up here on the counter. No. Here's the dish towel. You are dry. They will put away. And so I think it was a great way to not make me feel I was disabled and that I could do things.
And childcare. You have brothers and a sister, and you were entrusted with childcare.
So, yes. So there were five of us. I was second oldest. Well, no, it's farming. It is the way of big families, and I was second oldest. And so, my sister, when she was born, 8 years under me, it was a brother, me, two brothers, and then my sister. She was like my baby, and my mom happily let me treat her like my baby. So, I remember teaching her numbers, and I would sing her to sleep. So my nature was to be very nurturing, and I think, when you get someone who can help you with that, go on and help,
But it meant that you were taking responsibility.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And you also talk about a cornfield that was in your area where a lot of the kids came together. Tell me about your memories.
So I grew up in what is called Normal, Illinois. Yes, that's a real name. And at the time, it was a community of 1,200. And two blocks down the way was cornfields. And then if you went three blocks the other way, Illinois State University was there. Mm. I graduated from Normal Community High School. But there was a field, so my neighborhood was very eclectic, and this is one of the things I'm very grateful for. But there was a field across the way, and Dr. Luke, who was a professor at the university, his house was there. Three blocks down was a boys' home, and so there were boys there that didn't have homes. Across the street from there was a Pakistani family who was a teacher at the university. Around the corner and down the block, there was a mom whose husband actually went to a mental home. She had seven boys, and then the youngest was a girl, Teresa. So she and I were kind of friends because we both had brothers. And she stayed at our house more than anywhere else. But her mom became an alcoholic. Well, that wasn't sheltered from us. And right next door, we had an African-American family. And one of the things I remember is in that field, we all played. We were not allowed to discriminate against anyone because, everyone falls on hard times. And I think that's probably one of the greatest memories is we all played in that field together. And someone asked, clearly with my feet the way they were, I was not able to run like others. And, was I made fun of? I don't ever remember being made fun of. I had people ask why my feet were the way they were. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I didn't have words to explain it at the time because I think none of us really knew. But I think in that field, if I hit the ball, I got on the base. I don't know if there's an unspoken word that if she hits the ball, she goes. So I'm not sure, but lots of things happened in that space and working out with a lot of difference. And I think that made an impact because and the world is fun with difference. And
well, what do you think? I mean, I want to stay there for just one moment and think about what was going on there in the minds, because there's a little culture, right,
oh,
in
lots
that
of culture.
Field, right?
Mm-hmm.
Many people from many backgrounds, but you've created your own in this place where there are rules, written and unwritten, and I'm sure there are many other rules that apply to different people for whatever they brought to that field. As you look back now, what do you think was happening there? What was the rule about letting you on base that, and that in one way or another applied to everybody? It's just the specifics were different because they may have had a different background.
Whoever was on the field, you were accepted to be there. I think that was the piece. It didn't matter if you're Pakistani, if you're from the boys' home, if you're African-American, or if your mother was an alcoholic. it didn't matter. On that field, everybody was welcome to be a part.
But it's fascinating because you put a finger on this. We get into so many fights these days about, you know, equality. And then you find that in a community that had been advantaged for so long hears about a special rule, and all of a sudden they have to go to court because, oh, you've taken away our advantage. And I'm just listening to this saying there are ways in which equality is spelled in different ways, that the equality of each of you might mean a little different rule for everybody. Now we're equal.
Right. Well, and if you look at that, how would you feel like if you were a girl and your mom was an alcoholic, right? You're looking for acceptance. What would it been like in the 60s with all that was going on in the country and you were the only black family in that community? Mm-hmm. What would it feel like if you were, you know, in a whole nother country and you're Pakistani and the culture is totally different? What would it feel like when you know you don't have a mom and a dad? Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably, we didn't judge each other by that, but we all wanted to play ball and we had to have enough people to play. So we were kids and our parents all communicated. And of course, Doc Luke let us play in his backyard. It was his property. And I'm not sure. I know in my house, we were not, you couldn't make fun of anyone. I mean, that was a real strong thing. And it did not matter what color your skin was, obviously, or we would not have all been playing in that field together. So I don't know if culturally within that small community, and also with small communities, you can't be real picky because it's taken all of us. If we need help with bringing in corn or whatever it is, you relied on your neighbor. So I don't know if that played a part, being that small area. I don't know.
Fascinating stuff. Well, you went to school, and eventually your family relocated to North Carolina, but you stayed to go to community college.
So, right? Yeah. So, actually, in high school, I was slated to go to college. I started having some more issues. It's very interesting. I was never told I had no feelings in my legs. So I did drive. Sometimes I think, why did someone not say something? It probably wasn't the smartest thing. Fortunately, I didn't get in an accident, so that was good. But I began having some other issues that began happening my high school year. And so we decided, okay, we better go up to Chicago, see if we know what's going on. Some of it had to relate with the bowel and the bladder. I ended up getting a second-degree burn on my leg, and I had no recollection of how that happened. So this awakening came that there is something wrong, and now we have injury. We got to figure it out. So I had enough credits. I actually graduated high school early. We went to Chicago. We were there for a couple weeks. Then they said, no, we can't do surgery. We got to send you back because this thing has to heal. And with disability and when your body doesn't work appropriately, healing is a process. And so I'm sympathetic with those we serve and try to help encourage. Honor the body. You will get better in the end. And you get frustrated with the body sometimes. But so we came back, and then I ended up going to community college thinking, well, what am I going to do? I was working part-time. So I ended up going to community college, and my family moved, relocated back down to North Carolina. I finished up the semester, and then I followed. So, yes.
So now you're down, and you're getting pretty – what were you doing? Because you got to work right away.
Yes. Well, I grew up – we didn't have insurance, so the idea is you got to take care of yourself. I think, you know – parents didn't help. You know, it was a hard world. You just have to work. So as soon as I came down, I worked at Burlington Industries that used to have a thriving place here in over on Main Street. I worked in the industrial engineering department. And we did time study. So in factory work, you know, what production level needed to be done, how the maneuvering and spatially how that was efficient so you could get the most outcome. So that was part of what the industrial engineering did. And big shout out to Durham. At that plant, you went from raw cotton all the way to finished product, and there were very few factories like that. So it was fascinating, but I was all on the raw materials up to weaving. And then so I worked in industrial engineering, loved it.
Eventually, you met the man who would become your husband.
Yes. So I met James at church. So I'm an organizer. I look back and I think I always organize. So that clearly is inside of me. And so at our church, I was organizing a conference. And so he was a law school student at Duke. And so he was at our church and said, here, I'll volunteer. So I was impressed. It was funny. Dana said, what is this? And I think for me,
Dana's our producer who talked to you earlier, and when you said that you noticed that he was an organizer,
yes,
she thought, you know, not necessarily a chick magnet.
No, that's exactly what she said. And I said, no, it's funny what causes attraction. But I think I knew I had mobility limits. I knew where my boundaries were, and my kids, you couldn't leave clothes on the floor. There were things that had to be done for efficiency. So that whole industrial engineering piece actually became a foundation for me to be very effective in life, because I had to save energy, which efficiency and where you store things, how things are put away, creates efficiency. So he had a lot of those natural tendencies, and it one less fight, right? You don't need that. You need everyone on the same page. Right. So, yes.
Duke Law School,
yes. And so he ended up going into intellectual property. We knew each other in this other way, and he impressed me and then sent me flowers eventually. And I said, okay, this guy's interested. And so...
How big was the question of spina bifida, your surgeries? You had had many by then. How large did that loom in your courtship?
So, if you ask me and you talk to my kids, I'm pretty matter of fact. I think the disability certainly has made that part of who I am. So he wanted to find out about it. So we actually met my surgeon who removed the tumor from my spine once we got to North Carolina. And... wanted to understand what's the outcome and what could be expected. And fortunately for me, he was very open-minded, said, yes, she can have children, have them before she's 30 because her legs are only going to get weaker, and yes, one day she'll be in a wheelchair. So, very optimistic and hopeful and not like, oh, don't do this, don't do that. And at that point in time, we knew folic acid was a contributor to not having spina bifida. You had enough in your system. So he said, just... be on that for 6 months before you conceive, and,
And you did? Three kids.
Yeah, three kids, all perfect. I know the question is, are they okay? Yes, they're all perfectly fine.
Yeah.
Yes, so.
That was good. Did you stay home? You stayed home with the kids.
So I did my first two were 18 months apart, and we did, at that point, James took a job in Atlanta, so we moved to Atlanta. And there, after about my daughter was three, I said, let me start trying to work again. And so I actually got my real estate license thinking I could kind of blend the two. And so I began a journey in real estate and trying to manage time a little bit that way.
Atlanta, and eventually you end up in London, right?
So we did. Yes, my life has been all over the world, and probably that little field across the way made me open to new adventures and people. So we did. We ended up, we actually came back to North Carolina, and then my husband was at that time with GSK, Burroughs. Mm. There was a lot of mergers.
Yeah,
one
were
of the companies, right?
SmithKline at some
whatever
point, but
they
merged. Yeah.
So we went to London and worked in the international office. We were told we were going to be there for 18 months. And I was, again, selling real estate back in North Carolina. So when we went, we decided 18 months, the kids would probably get a lot more out of museums and venturing and learning as we were going to see things. And so we made an agreement to homeschool for 18 months. And that journey turned out to be 7 years.
Oh, dear.
Yes, I know. I might have reconsidered that if I had known the full story when we went there.
You weren't living in London, right? You were living in
We were living halfway between Oxford and London.
Uh-huh.
And so fortunately, a little village called Jordans, North Carolina, is where William Penn came from. And the gravesite is there, so quite historic. Anywhere in England, there's history. And while we were there in those 7 years, I had two surgeries while we were there and got to experience another joyful journey. I like to say... with disability, surgery is always a part. And I feel like from my own experience, you have kind of go through a 7 year where it's just gnarly and things happen. And then you get a plateau and you get, wonderful free years without anything. And then somewhere it creeps in again. And then you got to go in for some more tweaking. So I feel like that is a reality with disability. It's why I like to do what I do with adaptive sports, because it helps the mental and emotional and physical piece of staying healthy.
Well, you've talked about that, a cycle of kind of 7 years on, seven years off, more or less. as they repeat and as you sort of move forward and have more experience and more memory of what the last 7 years was like, does that get, is that easier? Is that more difficult? What's it like knowing that that's the pattern?
Honestly, yeah. I would rather never have to have a surgery again in my life. Mm-hmm. I think the older I get and when you've gone under enough, there are residual effects to it. I related very well to the military with PTSD and TBI because I certainly get me in that medical world. Oh, I know that journey because it's not, it is a world that's been helpful, but it is a world that also has pain. And so, you know, thinking I'm going, I'm sure with soldiers, you want to go back into battle. Well, if I could help it, no, but it's, right. It is a reality.
The Valor Games Southeast kicks off tonight. Veterans and military with disabilities will compete in 11 different adaptive sports. And Ashley Thomas is partly to credited with that. She has launched the event here in the Triangle. And just ahead, we'll talk more about her activities and the Valor Games on the State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Ashley Thomas and her nonprofit organization, Bridge to Sports, kick off the Valor Games Southeast tonight, brings together veterans and military members who are disabled who compete in sports that include archery, cycling, table tennis, and more. Ashley spent much of her life unable to participate in activities, including joining a gym. She remembers being denied membership to the Y because she was considered high risk. She now competes in adaptive sports and creates opportunities for disabled children and adults to do the same. And we're finding out about that journey that got you here. You talked about going to London with your husband, thought it was going to be 18 and children, thought it was going to be 18 months, turned out to be 7 years. You came back, and that's when your marriage suffered a bit. Tell us more about that.
Well, I would say probably I had two surgeries while we were living in England. And, you know, you go in thinking you're going to get something fixed. For me, it was a hip replacement, and at 34, yes, I needed a complete hip replacement. And that would explain a little bit of my walk, because, yes, I walked, but someone would say, you weren't really walking. You were moving. And it dislocated three times, and so the rule is you got to go back in. So we went back in almost a year later and had to go through surgery again, rehab again. At that point, my health began having a cascade, which we are learning more about these cascades. So my thyroid, I started becoming hypothyroid. I was profoundly anemic because the bone with all this other stuff was bleeding, and so I just went downhill significantly, and then I had a Chiari, which is associated with spina bifida. You can be born with them, and then at someday it's triggered, and you start having symptoms. For me, the symptom was I would bend my head a certain way, and I felt like a sledgehammer just went on the top of my head, and one day I about passed out, and I said, okay, I probably need to deal with this now. So we ended up my husband's boss was very kind and said, I'll send you back home on a 3-month furlough so that I could kind of come back here, get into a system that I understood a little bit better, see if we could figure some things out. So we did discover the Chiari, and yes, I had to have brain surgery. And it was just too much at that point, and I could feel my system, I could feel myself failing. And I do have a fighting spirit in me. And that was very scary because I thought it's always that will internally that would push me through. We came back. So I had Chiari decompression. That was in January. And then in May, I was still walking with crutches, canes, that whole joyful piece. I took a step and my other hip, I felt it. I had that searing pain again. I went, oh, shoot, we got to have more surgery. Because I'm now a very experienced patient, I'm calling Duke, and I said, I need to get on a surgery date. And so they said, we don't even know you. And I said, I know, but I know me. And so we had scheduled something for August, and I knew I couldn't endure the pain that long. So basically, calling, yeah. I moved my date up, and I saw the doctor in June. So fortunately, it was about 6 weeks with that horrible pain. And after the x-ray, the doctor said, I don't know how you're walking on that hip. It's totally collapsed, and I can get you in next week and get that fixed. So it's the other part of disability. I think often we live with a level of pain. There's certainly for me, fatigue was huge. I didn't know it, but it's just what I always knew. And, you know, I was a mother and I had three children. And children don't pick. You don't pick what you get. And I was committed to being a good mother, and that my disability, they were not here to serve me. I was there to care for them. So that was always my priority. So anyway, had surgery in July, and then ended up getting infection. So when I went back 6 weeks later in August, they called down, said, we have an emergency. We're sending her down in. So through all these surgeries, I tried to prep my kids because I didn't want them to be afraid of surgery. I didn't want them to think their mother was going to die. I mean, all these things go on in a child's mind. They don't understand. So with that particular surgery, I couldn't prep them. I couldn't have things in order. And with each surgery, we tried to do something fun so that they didn't feel the weight of what was coming. And so in that surgery in August, I was exhausted. I felt it. And I remember going in and, you know, when you've been under it enough, you kind of know the journey. And I remember going in there saying, God, keep my kids. There's nothing left in me to fight. And I don't know if I'm going to pull through this one. And that's how I went to that surgery.
What kind of conversations were you having with your husband through all this?
I think we're all very somber at this point. Yeah. There's no conversation because this has now been going on for four hard, hellacious years. It was back to back. There was no break coming in this. We also didn't have a lot of family support. We anticipated that coming back, but that didn't seem to be the piece. So that piece didn't help. So I'm very sympathetic when I hear other people's stories when you're kind of that isolated on that journey yourself. I think that's probably one of the things I have most compassion for because I've been there.
You did separate with your husband.
Yeah, that came a little bit later. And then I had one more surgery that year because after that, I dislocated again three times. And we just didn't recover. And I think my husband, you know, worked really hard to try to take care of the medical bills were exorbitant. There were no boundaries on that. And they would take everything you had to pay off. And we were one of those people that they took everything we had. Over that course of back in the U.S., that five-year journey. So anyway, I think my children definitely have a view on how that happened. It was different. So what often happens with disability is it's bigger than any one. I say for family members, stay close because people need it. In our case, we separated. Emotionally, neither one of us could handle it. We're both trying to figure it out, and so the marriage definitely broke down.
But I think this points to something. You know, unfortunately, I think in the Hollywood representations of this kind of a thing, when we talk about disabilities, it becomes this hero's tale, and everybody comes out looking pretty good. And the problem is that there's just these ups and downs, and there are fractures all over that, and you know, there are limits to all human endurance, everyone's endurance. And I wonder if you think about the ways in which we represent, particularly sort of in the popular culture, these questions that are far more complex than we might be getting otherwise.
Very, very complex. Yeah. There's many with the disability in the journey. And I want to talk very broadly here because if someone's dealing with Alzheimer's and a parent, they're going through it. If someone is dealing with any condition that can't be fixed, there's a journey, mental health. That's why I feel like as a society, if we really want to do a great job, know your neighbor. And when they need help, just show up there with food and say, can I help you today? Do you want me to run the vacuum? Because I was always one who wanted my house in order and I kept it in order. But it's those small things that you cannot do anymore. And I think about a couple of friends who showed up. What do you need me to do? And they didn't care if it didn't make sense. If you want to vacuum the floors instead of do the laundry? Today, just vacuum the floors. So I think there are a lot of oddities. I think when you're the main breadwinner, there's pressure because you have, you know, $100,000 worth of medical bills. How do you pay for it? So I think there's also a journey there. And who are the people coming alongside to say, let me help you get through this process? The children had their own journey. And I think everybody involved in that complex situation does have a piece. And this is why, know your neighbors, be a part, don't be afraid to come in.
Well, that's the part right there, again, because of these hero tales that we tell where everybody is supposed to go beyond the limits of human endurance, that if I don't live up to that role, I don't want to knock on her door and find out that she's going to ask me to do something I can't do. And I think that's maybe the danger in telling stories the way we do, where everybody ends up looking, you know, like the hero, when in fact you just crash and fall a lot. So if you knock on a door and there's something you can't do, okay, now you've learned a lesson.
Right.
But knock on the door.
Right, exactly.
Is what you're saying. Well, talk about this, because then you got the news that, or at least the advice that you start using a wheelchair.
Yes. So after that particular year, I didn't recover. And they said, it's time, you're going to have to use a wheelchair. And I remember thinking, I get one. And I cried at that, because it was so hard to use these legs. And now I have mechanical hips and my muscles weren't strong enough to hold them in and da, 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 da. So when I got the wheelchair, for me, it was a road of freedom. And it was for the first time I realized all of my quote unquote walking, I live with fatigue. And it was the first time I felt an energy I never had in my life. And this is now like early 40s, right? And I began going, gosh, I wonder if you could do a race. Because way back in my early years in you know, grade school and junior high, there were these walks. And, you know, you'd raise money, that walk concept. It's been around a long time. And I wanted to do it, but I wasn't allowed to because they didn't think I could do the walk. So I learned about a 5K, and I went, wow, I wonder if I could do this.
Your daughter played a big part. You participated.
Yes, my daughter did. It was at her school, actually, at St. Mary's. And so we signed up to do it together. A friend of mine said, you can go to the Y, because it is true. There was a time earlier when I was trying to work out when I had children, and they just said, you're too high risk, so you couldn't go to the Y. You couldn't go to they even pay money to go into a club and say, I just want to work out. And so a friend of mine said, go to the Y, you can go now. And so there was a big shift in that. And so I began training, it was over in Raleigh. It's what is now known as the Jingle Bell Run. And I learned what a bad team member I was through that experience. I learned all about sports in a way that most people would find humiliating, but I don't mind sharing my humiliation. So we show up, and I decided we were going to be cute. My daughter and I were going to be cute. We have black velour outfits. And it was the Jingle Bell Run, so we had to be festive. So we had Jingle Bell earrings, and we had red boas because we were going to be cute to run a 5K race. And yes,
boa.
I know. Well, hey, if you're going to do it big, right?
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Let's make yourself look awesome. So when I showed up, I quickly realized, shoot, this is not how we were supposed to run a race. But no one had ever told me how to run a race. And when I share this, I want us to think about children who don't get these experiences and all those developmental pieces that are so crucial to society and how we function as society. So my daughter, though, she was with me. We're on this together, Mom. We're doing this thing. The race director came up to me and said, you'll be starting the race. And I said, pardon me? I said, I've never run a race. This is the first one, and I've never done anything in a wheelchair before. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm going to be following. I thought I'd be following. And he said, nope, you'll be starting the race. So I knew the path, but one path I didn't put in is we had to start down this very big hill up to Hillsborough Road on St. Mary's. And so my daughter said, I'm with you, Mom. We're going. So we're going up this hill. We turn the next. There's four hills that you have to climb
she's
to get
pushing.
To the bell tower.
No,
no.
She's just with you. Okay.
That's right. She's just with me. By the time we got the first hill and the second hill, I'm now overheating because I'm not dressed appropriately. And she's right there with, okay, Mom, here, give me your stuff. I'll carry all your stuff. So she is now running and carrying all my gear that I'm stripping off. She's stripping off. And we get up to the top of the tower. But the other great thing about that race is all the people that passed me said, you're doing a great job. You're doing a great job. And so we get to the top of the hill, and I am coming around the hill. My arms are burning like fire. And I'm going down the hill, and my daughter's going, Mom, wait for me. And I'm going, I can't.
You left her in the dust.
And I left her in the dust. And, we got through it, and when we got back, she threw our stuff down. She said, I will never do another race with you. You left me, and I stayed with you. And it's funny because I realized I didn't know how to be a team player because I was always that solo person trying to make the accommodation, figure it out. That has changed since then. But it was a reality, and understanding where the boundaries were and knowing there is an appropriate dress for athletics. Wow, who would have thought? But I'm so glad I had someone with me. That's one thing I tell people. Take someone who will be with you.
Your daughter's a bodybuilder and has a big shoe collection.
Yes, she does, because all the shoes I couldn't get, I said, oh, you like those shoes? Yeah, let's buy them for you.
Your kids are on the team, and I know you brought some notes with you to talk about the encouragement that they've given you along the way, and I suppose we have time if you want.
Well, I wanted to share something my kids wrote. Now, this I'll go with my oldest one first, and he is 30, and this was my recent Mother's Day gift, and my son wrote, these are the words he wrote in, not the card. I am proud to have you as my mother. Being your son has not always been easy, but I would not have it any other way. The lessons you have taught me through your battles have made me a far better person than I would have ever been without you. The benefits of the struggle are well worth enduring the struggle. Keep fighting the good fight. It will be worth it all in the end. Love, Zan. So that was from my oldest son. And I think in light of, you know, everyone has a journey, I think that was fair. And then my daughter's card, she says, Mama, everywhere I go, I see your fingerprints in me, and I smile. Because everywhere you go, you leave behind encouragement, acceptance, equality, and love. And I am proud to carry on your legacy. You are my hero, my inspiration, my friend, and my favorite, my greatest source of comfort. I hope on this Mother's Day, you will know how deeply loved you are and how much I appreciate everything you do. I love you, your daughter, Jo. And then my youngest son graduated from UNC, so his thing was, I'm through, Mom. And I will share this with, it was funny because he's going to Wake Forest Med School. And in my true fashion, getting the list out, what do we need? He ended up saying to me, he said, Mom, this is my responsibility. You've done yours. I will handle this. And I think, you know, they all did take on a different responsibility because they learned differently because of my disability. But they're all wonderful, genuinely caring advocates for others who have lost their voice in their own right. And so I'm very proud of them. So that was a wonderful byproduct of living with a mother with disability.
Ashley Thomas, founder and executive director of the nonprofit Bridge to Sports. Ashley, what a pleasure. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Frank.
The Valor Games kick off tonight. They run through Thursday. Most of the events take place at the Dean Smith Center and Cameron Indoor Stadium and Lake Crabtree County Park. We've got all of the information at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.